My grandma Beryl always used to say that worse things happen at sea. The origin of this British idiom is very murky, but it basically means that things are not as bad as they seem, or things could be worse. For example, you may be having car trouble, but at least you're not dying of scurvy or shipwrecked on a dangerous coastline. But the flip side to this expression is that the stakes at sea are much higher. Worse things do happen at sea, and you are very vulnerable while out on a vessel in the vast open water. From very real dangers such as pirates, icebergs, sheets of ice, dehydration, illness, or storms, to legendary struggles such as sirens, mermaids, and sea monsters, the ocean is a lawless place, and help is usually miles away. Lighthouses, however, are a welcomed sight, a tower of hope in a storm, or a warning of shallow shoals, reefs, or treacherous rocks. But what about the people who man these beacons? They keep the lamps burning through hot summer days and snowy winter's nights. I once thought I'd enjoy this lifestyle. A quiet life, so connected with nature, the elements, and a serious sense of responsibility. That was until my grandma told me about the mariner on the mountain's edge. One blustery evening, while the wind was howling through the trees, my grandma and I curled up to talk serious, as we called it. The story begins on a crisp autumnal afternoon on the austere coastline of the British Isles. Although the day was clear and bright, the newly appointed lighthouse keeper could feel a storm brewing far off at sea. It wasn't long before a thick fog was rolling in with the tide. Soon, sheets of ice rain were blanketing the coast, and thunder and lightning were working in tandem to shake the earth and light up the sky. But the lighthouse keeper steeled himself, for although he was relatively new to his post, he remembered his training to always maintain the light, to serve those at sea who are at much greater risk than he. After hours of thrashing waves and relentless rain, massive swells began to pound ashore. At first, simply dusting the lighthouse tower with a salty spray. But as the intensity of the storm continued to grow, so did the surge of the tide. Waves were now battering the tower, striking the glass with such force they threatened to shatter the glass and douse the light. He had been valiant thus far, but the fear had grown too much. The keeper wanted out of the lighthouse, away from the waves, and to be safe nearer to town. He began to run down the spiral staircase, taking two steps at a time, calculating his escape as he went. When he came to the door, he stopped, knowing he should stay with the light. Stay in the tower, serve those in peril at sea. But he put himself first, opened the door, and stepped out into the storm. The next day was clear. The storm had passed as quickly as it had come. A group of mariners went out to the tower to find out why the light had expired. To their surprise, they found the tower empty. They began to search the cliff for the keeper, and soon found him, broken and distorted on a crash of jagged granite rocks. Legend has it that as he exited the tower to save himself from the storm, he was met by the ghosts of hundreds of sailors who had once died on the rocky shores, there to avenge him for his selfishness. Much like the idiom, I can't find an origin for this story either. But as Grandma always said, worse things do happen at sea.
Thank you.
and welcome to the season 3 premiere of The West London Witch, a podcast where we share stories about those moments where we find ourselves very much not alone. There is something so romantic and dreamy about being a lighthouse keeper. Your job is to tend to the beacon of light that keeps the coast safe, brings sailors home, and acts as a lifeline during storms and inclement weather. But it's also a terribly lonely job, isolated, and incredibly hard work. Because there are so few lighthouse keepers, it really is a job that holds a lot of fascination and mystery. Located on the scenic shores of Oregon, Haceda Head Lighthouse has been lighting up the coast since 1892. The beam from the 56-foot lighthouse is so strong, it can be seen for up to 21 nautical miles. But it's not just the sweeping vistas and brilliantly white, perfectly maintained lighthouse that draws visitors to this remote cliff edge, but also the stories of ghosts who still tend to the now fully automated light. Misty Anderson is the Director of Special Projects at Haceda Lighthouse Bed and Breakfast and is here today to share with us the incredibly fascinating history of Haceda Head Lighthouse and how it continues to keep the coast ablaze today. I'm Rebecca Strazina, and this is The West London Witch, Episode 41, Haunted Haceda Lighthouse.
In 1892, Congress passed an act to build another light station along the Oregon coast because there was about 30 miles of land that was completely dark and ships were crashing out on the shallow parts of the ocean. And so they chose Haceda Head because it stuck out into the water far enough that the light beam can shine 21 miles out to sea.
Construction began on the lighthouse keeper's homes first. There was a single home for the head lighthouse keeper and a subsequent duplex for the two assistant keepers. The bed and breakfast you see today is in the assistant keeper's duplex. The homes were not just solidly built to withstand the harsh Oregon coast, but they are also beautiful. They are built in the Queen Anne style and adorned with a vast porch, ornamental scalloped clapboard, and gingerbread trim. The pristine, bright white building with the earthy red roof is a striking sight to behold.
So in 1894, construction was completed. The lighthouse tower had been built. Both homes were built. And March 30th, 1894, the first order Fresnel lens was lit. So we had three light keepers who live out here on this very remote area where there's no roads to get there. If you go by horse or by wagon to get to the nearest town, it could take 2 days. Most of the time they would travel along the beach during low tide because the terrain through forest and mountains and muddy trails was so hard.
Three men were hired to man the lighthouse. They would either live alone or with their families. Because it was so difficult to get provisions to Haceda Head, in addition to the demands of the lighthouse, keepers and their families had to grow their own food, fish, hunt, gather firewood, and do laborious repairs on the houses and light tower. This was a very arduous way of life, and the keepers and their families had to be very hardy folk. Once a month, a timber ship would bring supplies like coffee, sugar, and flour. But mainly, they had to live off the land and make do with what they could grow, forage, and hunt.
And since there were three families so that they could take turns doing eight-hour shifts. One person always had to be up at the lighthouse tower watching the light, making sure it stayed lit. Because back then, the light was lit by oil, which was also brought in by ship, and had to be hauled up this big cliff to this lighthouse and stored up there. And then it would actually burn. And so the light keeper who was on duty at the tower would make sure the light was still burning, the oil was full, and there were no problems. But then they also had to do maintenance, like cleaning the lens and getting all the soot off of the glass. Those who were not at the lighthouse at the moment were down at the keeper's homes, and their duties were to keep the house and fence in good repair and to tend to the garden and to do any maintenance work that needed to be done, to take care of the animals. If there were families there, take care of the children. There were inspectors who would come out and make sure that people were actually taking care of the buildings, and everything had to be pristine white, freshly painted, and, you know, no wood rot. And if you've ever been to the Oregon coast, that's nearly impossible with all the wind and the moisture and the salt. So we still, to this day, are constantly, you know, replacing wood and painting and washing the salt water off the windows.
Being a lighthouse keeper was very much an all-encompassing way of life. And it didn't just affect the grown-ups who made the choice to live there.
This also meant that you educated your own children. So they built a little schoolhouse down by the creek where the garden was, and they educated their own children. And there was a couple homesteading families nearby whose children who also went to school with them. And that means that they also, you know, celebrated all the normal things that you have in life, like births and marriages and birthdays and sometimes deaths as well. It was not uncommon for a child to pass away, or a husband or a wife, or, you know, it was very much everyday life, just in a very remote location.
Life at the lighthouse continued in this manner for decades, up until the 1930s, when a massive change washed over the totally remote area of Haseda Head. The Coast Highway now slithered right alongside the light tower and the lighthouse keeper's home. And with the highway came new innovation.
And once they were able to build this road and bring cars in, they were also able to bring electricity in. So now the lighthouse tower is electrified, and the wick is no longer a burning wick for the light. They actually put in a light bulb. So that required a lot less maintenance as far as like hauling up oil and keeping it fueled and cleaning the soot. Also, it became automated, where it used to have to be that a light keeper every 30 minutes would run up the stairs to pull the weight, and then it would take 30 minutes for the weight to fall. And as the weight's falling, that's making the light spin. So they would be running up and down stairs all day and night. They were able to create a mechanism that was automated by electricity, and now it turns by itself.
With the advent of electricity and automation, there was less need for actual manpower to keep the tower alight. So the main lightkeeper's home was removed, leaving only the duplex, which now housed the head keeper and one assistant.
So life got a little bit easier. It was easier to go to town, easier to get supplies, but still a very wild part of the Oregon coast with many storms and not much assistance around.
The next chapter of the lighthouse's story takes place during World War II. The U.S. were concerned that Japanese submarines would aim for the Oregon coast. So they stationed a military base at the Haseda Lighthouse to ensure the safety of domestic shores. 50 to 70 soldiers and their dogs were stationed at the lighthouse and patrolled the coastline day and night.
So when they removed the headlight keeper's house, this left a big open space. And so they were able to build barracks for these men to live in. And their dogs had their own dog houses down on the hillside overlooking the ocean. And the duplex that was left was actually used as a medical facility. So anyone who was ill or injured was taken care of inside the keeper's home. And this went on until the war ended. And after that, they no longer had it as a military base, and they no longer kept a lightkeeper there anymore. Everything was automated and electrified. The lighthouse tower and the beach are now managed by the State Parks of Oregon, and the U.S. Forest Service acquired the keeper's duplex and the grounds around that.
The Forest Service didn't really know what to do with this newly acquired property, but they did know that they wanted it to live on.
They tried having it as a residence or an office, but it just really wasn't very functional or useful for them. But they didn't want to see it destroyed like the first home. They wanted to preserve the home. So they had the idea of partnering with Lane Community College and making it an annex for their school. And the deal was they would only have to pay $1. And I can't remember if it was $1 a month or $1 a year, but it was something like nominal, you know? But they had to keep caretakers on site who would maintain the property and keep the home in good standing. And then the college would be allowed to have classes out there. Because it was so remote, it was more of like, let's go out for a few days. We'll stay there on campus, the house. We'll stay on site for a couple of days and have like a writer's retreat or a photography class or, you know, some sort of like, you know, multi-day event. It wasn't just a daily class that you drove to. And they had that for a couple decades. And they actually did changes to the home and made the bedrooms upstairs into like dormitories for people to stay. It's supposed to be boys on one side, girls on the other. But I've heard a lot of stories from people who've come through on our tours that said there was a lot of commingling, a lot of partying, and good times to be had.
After Lane Community College ended their decades-long relationship with the Forest Service, it was decided that the lighthouse would be converted into a bed and breakfast and that the money it generated would continue to fund the restoration and preservation of the property.
And they put out a bid to try to find somebody who could make that happen. And Mike and Carol Corgan were one of 500 applicants. And they won the job. They were restaurant owners in Portland, and they thought that this would be a great retirement project. But converting a 100-year-old home into a hotel is not a retirement project, as they were to soon find out. They lived in half of it and then rented out the other half. And again, they had to restructure the interior so the bedrooms were appropriate for renting out. It was a duplex, so it's kind of a mirror image of itself. So there's two of everything. So upstairs we have three bedrooms with bathrooms, and then downstairs we have a parlor on each side, and the parlor has the ocean view and fireplaces. And then we have two kitchens. One is the professional kitchen where we cook the 7-course breakfast and cater for weddings. And then the other kitchen is for the guests to use. And then we have the dining room, which used to be two smaller dining rooms, but the wall was taken out when Lane Community College was there because they wanted to create a classroom. So we have one big, large dining room.
The lighthouse is now obviously a guest house, event location, and since it's on the National Registry of Historic Places, the team have also turned it into an interpretive center where history tours are given to the public. But it's not just the fabulous history and beautiful scenery that brings visitors to Hasita Lighthouse.
So where do the first stories of the ghosts come from?
Aha, yes, good question. So for those of you listening who aren't familiar with the ghost stories of Hasita Lighthouse Bed and Breakfast, supposedly we have a resident ghost named Rue. And that's R-U-E. And we know her name because in the 60s, when the caretakers were there for the Lane Community College, they were experiencing, because they live on site. There's an apartment in the basement and they live on site and they're there day and night all year round, regardless of weather. They were experiencing some really strange things. And they considered it to be paranormal. And so they wanted to find out who was there. So they pulled out their Ouija board, because everybody has a Ouija board. And they pulled it out and they asked who is here. And it's spelled R-U-E. So they call her Rue. And we've done some research trying to find out if, you know, Rue was somebody's last name, somebody's first name. Who would this person be? We have to assume that it was during the Lightkeeper time, because women weren't there during the military base, you know. The problem is that women and children weren't documented. So we have a list of all the Lightkeepers who were there, but unless there were some notes in a journal or in a newspaper article, we don't really know the names of the wives and the children.
Legend has it that Rue was a Lightkeeper's wife living on the property with her family. And tragically, her daughter drowned and died on the site. A child did die at the lighthouse, but her mother's name was not recorded.
They moved away, and when she passed on, her spirit came back to Hasita Head because she's looking for her daughter and wants to be close to her daughter. And there's many things that support that story. We have found articles about a woman who lived there and lost her child. We've had a lot of experiences that are just like a woman taking care of the home, where you hear like sweeping sounds in the attic. Things will get tidied up around the rooms. Guests have said that, you know, they'll leave their slippers over here in the corner, and in the morning they'll wake up and they'll be very tidily put at the foot of their bed, nice and neat. And some things get moved from a side table and put into the closet. There's a story from when they were doing some work on the attic windows, I think it was. And this is a famous story that was in the newspaper and everything. And there was a worker who accidentally broke the window glass and it fell into the attic. And he came back later to clean it up and it had already been swept up.
As the construction worker came into the attic to clean up the glass, the fact that it had been neatly swept up was hardly his greatest concern. For as he stood there, staring at the puzzling pile, he looked up to see a ghostly woman watching him. He bolted down the attic stairs and out of the house and refused to ever return.
And so what we've experienced with Rue, on day-to-day basis, just as we're going about, you know, running the bed and breakfast, which is, you know, cooking breakfast and cleaning rooms and greeting guests, is almost every single housekeeper that we've had has said that they've made the bed and then they'll turn around and like there'll be an indentation, like someone has sat on the bed and is looking out the window. And this is in multiple rooms. There have been things getting moved, like I said, but then also like sometimes even I've experienced this where like you smell perfume, like a grandma's perfume, you know, even though no one has been there. And it's not like the kind of perfume that people wear these days. It's just a, like grandma's perfume. I don't know how better to describe it. She will take things from the professional kitchen. Like we'll be missing something that we use on the regular. And we're like, where did this go? Nobody knows where it went. And then a couple days later, it will just magically be put back.
Even Misty has experienced the ghostly goings-on of Hasita Lighthouse.
I would go through the house. I work late. And so I would go through the house and make sure all the windows were locked. And we have these latches that you kind of twist. And I'd go and check all those. There's probably like 8 windows. And then I would go put my stuff together. And then I would go back through and I would see that like half of them would be open. And I asked the caretakers, what are you guys doing? Why are you playing this joke on me? Because I totally thought they were doing that. And they're like, we don't know what you are talking about. Like they swear that they didn't ever do that.
That's a very common trait of the lighthouse. It makes you question yourself and the others around you.
I've heard a female voice before. It was a day that we were closed. It was winter time. So we closed like 2 days a week to do repairs and stuff. And so the house is empty. There's no other staff there except for the caretaker and I. And we're working on repairing a bed. And he's up on the third floor and I go down to the basement to get a tool. And as I come up to the first floor, I hear like a young woman's voice talking. And I just assumed that his girlfriend had showed up. And so I came upstairs. I'm like, oh, hey, you know, where is such and such? And he's like, no, she's not here. Nobody's here. I'm like, but I heard a voice, you know, and I'm looking all around the house because this is a public place. So, you know, we have people who park at the State Park Beach, walk up to the lighthouse and then come and like look at the house. So I'm looking all around to see if there's anyone outside. And I did not see anyone outside around the house. Just because I didn't see it doesn't mean they weren't there. But I have this woman's voice talking. It sounded very much in the house, like, and there was no one around. So
caretakers often feed back to Misty that they hear unexplainable noises in the house when it is empty. They find things in odd locations or simply realize that things have gone missing altogether. Several caretakers have complained that while lying in bed, all of the items on their bedside table have gone flying onto the floor.
I've had multiple caretakers who have had pets in the basement, and they say their pets would just sit there at the closet door and just stare at something.
One caretaker who lived there for 4 years said that he had become so accustomed to the ghostly commotion, he would wear massive headphones at night to watch TV or play video games so he wouldn't be disturbed by the constant activity. But of course, it's not just the staff who experience Rue, because there is a constant stream of guests ever flowing through the property.
It was like, I think it was like shoulder season. So it was kind of like late fall. And for some reason, the house was rather empty. I had gone into the city to buy supplies. And when I came back, everybody was gone. Like they all went to dinner, which was weird. And so the house was empty and I just unloaded groceries and did all that. And then the next morning I was on breakfast and it was during the time of COVID where we had to seat everybody separately rather than around one big family. So we had tables in each room and everybody was spread out. And I was talking to one couple in the East Parlor and they said that they had arrived later than check-in. There were no other guests there. They let themselves in with the code that we give them. And when they were in the house, they could hear things going on, yet nobody was there. And they said when they were in the parking lot, they saw a woman standing in the window of, they didn't know at the time, but it was Queen Anne room. So they thought somebody was there, but then they go inside and no one was there, but they heard things. And so they got so freaked out that they actually left and stayed at another hotel that night. But they came back in the morning to have the 7-course breakfast. So they told me that story in one room. And then later towards the end of breakfast, I'm in one of the other rooms and this couple was telling me that same night when they were coming back from dinner, that they saw a woman up in the Queen Anne room looking down at them.
Rue isn't known to be aggressive or mean, but she does frighten some guests and has been known to gently touch people's arms or legs while they are resting in bed.
We have people who get scared sometimes and some of them leave and then some of them just, you know, they deal with it. And sometimes they get haunted and sometimes they don't.
Oddly enough, though, it's not just Rue. There have been many reports of spirits that are not connected to the grieving mother.
Rue is our resident ghost that everybody asks about and we tell the stories about. But there have been a lot of guests who have said that they've heard children playing on the stairs. We have these from the first floor, we have these stairs that kind of like they twist up through like an open hallway and they go up to the bedroom. So there's a small like 8-foot landing at the top where the 3-bedroom doors are, and then the stairs twist down, so it's open. And so they'll be in their rooms and they swear that they hear children like laughing and playing and running up and down the stairs, and they come out to the landing and there's no one there. Well, we don't even allow children under the age of 10 to stay the night. So it would not be a common thing to hear a child playing like that. Definitely not multiple children. So that's something that's always been interesting to me, that we've gotten a lot of reports of that, but no documentation on it. They also say, I've read a lot in the stories people have left, because we have a book in each room where people can write down their experiences. And so we have years and years worth of journals of guests' experiences. And some of them are just like, hey, it was great here. And then others are like, so I had this haunting, or this happened in my room, and I don't normally believe in this, but I saw this move and I heard this, and I swear, you know, like, so there's a lot of that. A lot of it has said they've seen a gray cat that will like run across the first floor or through the parlor. We don't have cats that live in the house, and I would know if a cat was there because I'm extremely allergic to cats. But there's, so I guess we have like a gray ghost cat.
Because the lighthouse and Rue have been in articles, books, and TV shows, paranormal investigators have flocked to see what, if anything, they can find on the property. Interestingly enough, they too have found evidence of spirits other than Rue. Men, children, the cat, and other non-grounded spirits have all been experienced in the house.
I have a theory on that, but I'm not a professional. But in my 6 years of living there and listening to staff and listening to caretakers and listening to guests, is I think that Rue is our resident ghost who's always there. And she's just part of the family, and she's helping take care of the place, and she's watching out. And then I think we have like transient spirits that don't necessarily live there, but they come through the place from time to time. And I think that's where we get the sense of a male presence, or when we have a lot more activity going on. Also, and this is really interesting to me, is shadow people. Before the light station was there, there's a whole history of Native Americans living there. We have to remember that they had a really long time of living there and having families there and doing ceremonies there and, you know, living off the land. And they also had deaths and experiences there. And so I've had many people tell me that during a certain period of time when the Oregon Department of Transportation was doing work on the highway and the land was being disturbed a lot, the caretakers at that time and some of the guests and some of the staff would report seeing shadow people like outside, like shadows of people figures. And I thought that was interesting. And the more that I've learned about Native American cultures is that is a common lore in their culture is that shadow people are like, you know, our versions of ghosts. And so to have people report on that, I found that to be interesting, and that represents and reminds us that there was history there and life there and things going on there before we even, the white people, came and built this light station.
Hasita Lighthouse is an intriguing location because it really has it all. Full-bodied apparitions, shadow people, poltergeist activity, disembodied voices, people being touched, smelling ghostly scents, and even pets reacting to unseen stimuli. But with a history so vast and ever-changing as the tide, it's no wonder that this is such a spirited location. And the owners and staff have embraced the history and the haunts that come with it. They are even conducting ghost tours on October 30th for guests to come and experience the activity for themselves. All information can be found at www.hasitalighthouse.com.
Well, I just like to acknowledge that, you know, everything that we're doing now, running the bed and breakfast, running the gift shop, having the special events, having the interpretive center there, having that all open to the public, that's really such a lucky gift that the world has. And everyone should come experience it if they can. And the reason that this happens is because of the people who are currently there working hard to make it happen. And the people who have worked hard for all those decades, you know, the light keepers and the military personnel and the caretakers during the Lane Community College, like, it's taken as long as this house has been alive. And I do talk about it as if she's alive, because I feel very much like this house has its own energy and presence, and in this, it's its own being. It's taken all those people doing all those great things and working so hard up to just today, where everyone worked hard to make that 7-course breakfast so that the guests who came to visit and spend their money there, you know, leave happy and full. The money that they've spent with us, that goes back into keeping the history going and the research going, and then us being able to tell stories to you and your listeners, and to tell stories to the people who come visit, either on a tour or by staying the night, and then the school children who come out to see it and hear the history. And just, I just think it's just a beautiful legacy that's ongoing and happening because of everybody who has put their love into the place.
Do you have a spooky story you'd like to share? I'd love to hear it. Drop me an email at thewestlondonwitch@gmail.com or find us on Instagram and Facebook at thewestlondonwitch. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. And come and follow us for additional content on Instagram and Facebook. Until next time, merry meet, merry part, and merry meet again. The West London Witch is created by me, Rebecca Strazina. Our sound designer and production magician is the incredible Danny Cross. Our theme music was bespokely written and performed by the wickedly talented Kyle Hall. Our cover art is the beautiful collaboration between Lizzie Wilson and Jake Bowser. Special thanks to Ms. Sinead Bowers, our quality control and biggest cheerleader. And thank you to you, all of our listeners all over the world. These are your stories. Thank you for sharing them.